If you use touchscreen, an automated door opener, or an automated faucet today, it is probably based on the technology of inventor and entrepreneur Hal Philip. We've been having some great conversations with Hal, and we will continue it with our final podcast today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Hal, we have been talking about your journey as an entrepreneur and the difficult trails that you had to traverse in order to get to the success that you had. You had patents, but you had to go into a lot of litigation, a lot of headbutting in order to maintain your intellectual property, which you did. And it ended out to be pretty good. You sold the company. It was now Atmel's problem. You sold your company, Quantum Research, to Atmel. It was their problem. So you handed over everything, your patents, your litigation, all of the challenges, all of the good stuff to a third company. And they actually settled your lawsuit with Apple and all of these other good things. I want to talk to you about some kind of philosophical ideas. You achieved a great deal of success that young entrepreneurs today only dream about. I think that a lot of students that I've met as a professor would love to be an entrepreneur. They would love to achieve the success that you have. Based on your experience, what is your advice to the budding inventive entrepreneur?
I would advise somebody to go start a, join a startup where there are other people and outside capital involved. So in my case, I risked my own capital, my own hours, my time, everything, my life, my social life. It was 120 hour weeks.
120 hour weeks.
Yeah, there were no weekends. Believe me, from morning till night, I was eating, living, and breathing my company.
Wow.
And so it was a very risky proposition.
And that's not good. You get ingrown personality sometimes when you do that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
120 hours a week,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Sometimes, but 100 was not unusual at all. 120 happened quite frequently.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would advise them against going into a venture without the support?
Yeah, I think entrepreneurs need support, especially if they're starting out for the first time. It's better to learn at the hands of somebody who's done it before, or at least be just a part of the process so you're not risking everything. So in my case, I had a long, torturous career, starting from an employee of a major, at that time, Fortune 500 company in the test and measurement space to becoming a consultant, contractor, then inventor and patent licensing guy, and then finally a company owner and operator, which I never intended to do. So that sort of fell into my lap sort of by accident, which I think we covered in a previous podcast.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was a very torturous path, and it was fraught with many, many risks, a lot of heartache, a lot of people attacking my patent portfolio, ripping it off, generating thousands and millions in legal fees. And so, it was not for the faint of heart. And I don't advise people to go down the path that I did. But I don't want to dissuade anybody from becoming an entrepreneur. I just don't want to see, I would not like to see somebody going down the path that I trod. Don't do this at home is what I tell people.
In fact,
it's not a good way to go about doing it.
I'm encouraging Hal to write a book about his experience. And he came up with the title, what was it?
Don't do this at home.
Don't do this at home. Okay. In fact, because of my experience with you and the work that I did with Neopath as an expert witness, I tell young budding entrepreneurs to be very careful in what they do and to make sure that the first thing they do is involve lawyers. They need to know the cost of patents and the cost of patent litigation, because almost invariably, as soon as you achieve a degree of success, you're going to be sued.
Yeah, you're going to be ripped off and sued.
Ripped off.
Or at least ripped off, and maybe you're going to have to sue, or you will be sued as well. So it's really fraught with enormous risk. And that is something very characteristic of intellectual property generally, especially patents and that kind of intellectual property, as opposed to copyright intellectual property. Copyright is much more secure. Unless you're actually plagiarizing somebody, you're pretty safe in whatever you do, writing music or books or articles or whatever. But in terms of actual technology, intellectual property, we have patents. Yeah, it's fraught with enormous amounts of risk, and nobody will come to your aid and assistance. Nobody. No, but you're alone. So you better have deep pockets to defend yourself or you're going to go broke very quickly.
Okay.
If you have a great idea, if you're really as successful as you think you're going to be, which is why you're going into business in the first place, you're not going to go into business to be a has-been or a, you know, some wishy-washy company in the middle of the road. You want to be excellent and outstanding and be a smash success. So if you were actually going to end up being those things, you're going to be attacked from all sides. You're going to be ripped off from all sides and attacked.
And as we mentioned, I guess these larger companies don't have a sense of morality that they will go ahead and bulldoze forward in order to make profits at the cost of leaving some entrepreneurs underfunded in their wake.
That's correct. I mean, it's a very amoral process. There's nothing personal about it. They just want to take your stuff when they find it and use it in their own products and services and pay the least amount possible for it. And sometimes the least amount possible is to start out by paying you nothing, acknowledging nothing, and letting the lawyers take over if it even gets that far. For big corporates, it's a matter of attrition. When they take somebody's technology from outside and incorporate it inside to some product or service and don't pay for it, they're inviting you to do something about it. But most times, people don't have the money. You know, who has the money to go sue Apple? Who has the money to go sue Microsoft for something? Mm-hmm. They will crush you with legal fees. So most people don't even start. And if you have enough money to go sue, they'll employ a pattern of attrition against you. They'll make it a very expensive lawsuit with lots of discovery process and so on, and the lawyer bills will ratchet up on you.
Explain discovery, because that's a big part of litigation.
It is a huge part of litigation. So discovery is when your opponent gets to come in and search through your file cabinets for everything and anything. By the time they're done, they'll know the color of your underwear.
Okay.
Almost literally. They'll see receipts for everything. They'll see letters for everything. They're entitled to all this stuff. And if you don't give it to them, the judge will throw the book at you.
Yeah.
So you have to give them what you want. And now your lawyer can contest what they're trying to discover. But if it's in the least possible, even minutely related to the case at hand, they will end up being entitled to it and you'll have to fork it over. And it could be very embarrassing to you, by the way.
Yeah.
And there's no guarantee of any privacy unless there's a security, a secrecy order clamped around the case, and that's not a given. So,
okay. In the lawsuit I was in, they did clamp security around everything. So I guess that is something that could happen. So basically your advice to budding inventive entrepreneurs is to make sure you have the foundation before you launch. To have the foundation legally, experientially, and in other ways, financially, I guess.
Financially is a big one, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you're going solo, and the point is, don't, as a first venture, don't go solo. I mean, learn at the feet of somebody else who's doing it, or somebody else who's risking their money. You know, learn the ropes. By all means, be involved. You know, do the 80 and 100 hour weeks. By all means, do all those things, but try not to risk your personal life for it. You know, so learn, but do the big risk a little later in life when you have a little more wisdom, a little more knowledge of how the process works.
And where would a budding entrepreneur go for this foundation? If I was a garage guy putting together some sort of great invention, I don't know if there's any way you could go in order to get that foundation. It's almost a hopeless situation.
No, you can find another company that started by some other entrepreneur who's made a success out of themselves. So you can get in league with somebody who has trodden that path before. There are, I think, many entrepreneurs who have been through that path who would have an open mind about forming a joint venture or starting a company together with you or funding or mentoring you. I think that's very possible to do. But if you can become a part of another startup that's not necessarily of your idea, but just to learn the ropes of what it's like to start a company and to run it and to do all the things that go along with that, like marketing and everything else, do that first and then start a company a little later in life with your own ideas.
I know that Peter Thiel has this thing called the Thiel Scholarships, where he gives people big bucks not to go to college, but to rather become entrepreneurs. But immediately they are backed with finances, they are backed with legal expertise, mm-hmm. and so they have all of
that. That's great. Backing. That's fantastic. Fantastic.
Too bad there aren't more of those, I think.
Correct.
It comes out just
a
handful a year.
But you know, the mortality rate is what I was trying to say there of startups is huge. It's probably 80, 90%.
Yeah.
And everybody thinks that they can do it better and they will succeed. Otherwise, you wouldn't become an entrepreneur. Of course, you think you're going to succeed and be a smash success and make billions of dollars. Everybody starts out thinking that way. But the fact of the matter is maybe 10, 20% at most become successful.
Okay. Yeah, you were mentioning a lot of young entrepreneurs, including yourself, were a little naive.
Very naive.
In what you were doing.
When I started off, I was extremely naive. If knowing what I know now, I wouldn't have done what I did.
Okay.
No way.
Well, let me change the topics a little bit. One of the things that the Bradley Center does is purport that there are things that people can do that computers will never be able to do. One of the big ones is creativity. And going back to the work of Roger Penrose and Hadamard, who wrote a book about it, Hadamard, the great mathematician, that creativity in the human mind comes in little flashes of genius. Roger Penrose talked about the idea that that ideas, creative ideas, would come to him, not in thoughts, not in images, not in words, but they would come to him and boom, there they were. Now, it might take him a day or a week or even longer to work out the details, but they were just implanted in his head from somewhere. And this is probably something that computers will never be able to do. You and I have talked about this a little bit, and you've had epiphanies. Some of the ideas that you've come up with have been kind of flashes of genius. Okay. Could you relate to some of those and where you've had the flashes of genius?
Yeah, it usually comes late at night in bed trying to get to sleep, and I'm sort of tossing and turning, but I've got problems on my mind. I'm thinking about the workload that, or the work that I did the day before, and I've got a problem to solve, and suddenly something just pops in my head. And that's happened on several, well, at least two occasions that I remember, and I think more. But, you know, I was very busy during that time, so I'm probably not remembering everything. But yes, it sort of pops in your head. It comes from like out of nowhere. It's really weird.
Do you have some specific anecdotes?
Well, I have two, but depending on time here, I guess the first one was an optical sensor, which actually we co-authored and presented a paper on.
Yes,
you and
yes.
I, so called the, what was it called again? The optical
light bridge.
That's yes. Right. So the light bridge sensor.
And the basic idea was
to create a virtual summing junction for photons. Which of course is impossible in practice, but in a virtual sense, you can do that considering light as AC light sources, as alternating light sources. You can create a virtual summing junction. It was really kind of a flash of insight that let me do some things with optical sensing that couldn't otherwise be done.
But you were saying that you kind of needed darkons. You needed the opposite of photons.
You need to think about negative light.
Uh huh. Which is
how do you think of what is negative light? There's no such thing as negative light, right? I mean, you can have darkness, which is the absence of light, but that's not negative light.
Right.
So this thought process, this thought experiment required negative light.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, light that would cancel out positive light.
And you figured out your epiphany was how to get rid of this.
Yeah. The epiphany was that I didn't need to actually create darkons. I just had to take an existing light source and pulse it off.
I see.
Yeah.
Now,
and that was a patent that generated a fair amount of money for me over its lifetime.
And you used it eventually for the garage door, or the, not the garage door.
Automatic doors.
Automatic door openers and the faucets.
Faucet sensors, yes.
That detected the hands underneath the faucet.
Correct, yeah.
So do you remember how it popped into your head? Was it just kind of a vague idea? Or was it to what degree was it developed?
It pretty much just popped in my head.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, Nikola Tesla talks about when he invented, I believe it was the brushless motor, that it kind of popped in his head while he was walking along, and the whole idea was there, fully formed, and he stopped and smoothed off some dust and actually wrote a schematic of what was going on in his mind. So that was the way it was with you, too.
Yeah, it was. But I would say that it happens, at least for me, in the context of I had to solve a problem.
Yeah.
So if I didn't have a problem to solve, it wouldn't have popped in my head because it wasn't on my mind.
Sure.
So it just popped in as a solution to a problem that I'd been working on for quite a long time.
Okay.
So it just magically, there it was, and it was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that'll work.
That'll work.
And it did. Yeah.
Friedrich Gauss, the mathematician, also had a situation like that where he woke up in the morning and he just had an idea. It was a problem he was working on, but he was really surprised that his solution was nowhere in the area that he was thinking about. It was brand new, totally outside the box.
Well, that's even more remarkable.
Yeah, that is even more remarkable. Mm-hmm. So you have another anecdote. You said you had two. What was the other one?
Well, the other one was capacitive sensing. So in that area, I was trying to figure out how to lower the cost of the capacitive sensing technology that I had patented. And so There were these very small 8-pin microcontrollers that were available. You could buy them for about 30 cents. Really incredibly cheap. And you could put your own software inside and turn it into whatever it was capable of doing. And the trick was, the question was, could I turn that into a capacitive sensor somehow with almost nothing, no external or extra parts involved? And that was also late at night, lying in bed, you know, tossing and turning and mulling over the problems of the day and what I had to do tomorrow, and just suddenly materialized. That one I remember more because that was a more immediate epiphany than the first one, the optical sensor. So this happened in about 1996 or early 97. And it just popped in my head. It was the most amazing thing, and it worked. And it went against everything that the chip manufacturer told you that you could do with that chip. But I knew a little bit more about how the chips operated inside that the manufacturers weren't telling people. So okay. I did cheat in that regard. Well, it's not really cheating, but I had that additional bit of knowledge. And that let me know almost immediately when it popped in my head, yeah, that'll work. That'll work. And I tried it the next day. It was easy code to write to get it to do that, and it worked immediately. So
wow,
that was very cool.
So it was.
And I also knew at the same time that that would make me wealthy.
Really?
Yeah, I knew. The next thought I had after thought of that lying in bed was, this is worth millions and millions and millions.
Wow.
I knew it immediately. And it was. That was a correct intuition.
And so that was a very successful piece of technology.
Yes, very, very successful. That really powered the company forward.
That is amazing. Hal, Philip, thank you for spending this last few podcasts with us. What an amazing story you have. When can we expect your book?
Okay, let's leave it at that.
Okay, we don't want to go there.
We don't want to go
there. We want to go there. I'm trying to encourage Hal to write a book, but he's a little bit reluctant. And with all of the challenges that he went through, I can understand that. Well, that concludes our time with Hal Philip. What a wonderful venture of all the things we've learned. So until next time on Mind Matters, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.